This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents Count Zero, written by William Gibson and narrated by Jonathan Davis.
Count Zero interrupt. On receiving an interrupt, decrement the counter to zero. Chapter 1. Smooth-running gun. They set a slam hound on Turner's trail in New Delhi, slotted it to his pheromones and the color of his hair. It caught up with him on a street called Chandini Chowk, and came scrambling for his rented BMW through a forest of bare brown legs and pedicab tires. Its core was a kilogram of recrystallized hexagene and flaked TNT. He didn't see it coming. The last he saw of India was the pink stucco facade of a place called the Kush Oil Hotel. Because he had a good agent, he had a good contract. Because he had a good contract, he was in Singapore an hour after the explosion. Most of them, anyway. The Dutch surgeon liked to joke about that, how an unspecified percentage of Turner hadn't made it out of Palam International on that first flight and had to spend the night there in a shed, in a support vat. It took the Dutchman and his team 3 months to put Turner together again. They cloned a square meter of skin for him, grew it on slabs of collagen and shark cartilage polysaccharides. They bought eyes and genitals on the open market. The eyes were green. He spent most of those 3 months in a ROM-generated SimStim construct of an idealized New England boyhood of the previous century. The Dutchman's visits were gray dawn dreams, nightmares that faded as the sky lightened beyond his second-floor bedroom window. You could smell the lilacs late at night. He read Conan Doyle by the light of a 60-watt bulb behind a parchment shade printed with clipper ships. He masturbated in the smell of clean cotton sheets and thought about cheerleaders. The Dutchman opened a door in his back brain and came strolling in to ask questions. But in the morning his mother called him down to Wheaties, eggs and bacon, coffee with milk and sugar. And one morning he woke in a strange bed, the Dutchman standing beside a window spilling tropical green in the sunlight that hurt his eyes.
"You can go home now, Turner. We're done with you. You're good as new."
He was good as new. How good was that? He didn't know. He took the things the Dutchman gave him and flew out of Singapore. Home was the next airport Hyatt. And the next. And ever was. He flew on. His credit chip was a rectangle of black mirror edged with gold. People behind counters smiled when they saw it, nodded. Doors opened, closed behind him. Wheels left ferro-concrete. Drinks arrived. Dinner was served. In Heathrow, a vast chunk of memory detached itself from a blank bowl of airport sky and fell on him. He vomited into a blue plastic canister without breaking stride. When he arrived at the counter at the end of the corridor, he changed his ticket. He flew to Mexico. And woke to the rattle of steel buckets on tile, wet swish of brooms, a woman's body warm against his own. The room was a tall cave. Bare white plaster reflected sound with too much clarity. Somewhere beyond the clatter of the maids in the morning courtyard was the pounding of surf. The sheets bunched between his fingers were coarse chambray, softened by countless washings. He remembered sunlight through a broad expanse of tinted window, an airport bar,
Puerto Vallarta.
He'd had to walk 20 meters from the plane, eyes screwed shut against the sun. He remembered a dead bat pressed flat as a dry leaf on runway concrete. He remembered riding a bus, a mountain road, and the reek of internal combustion. The borders of the windshield plastered with postcard holograms of blue and pink saints. He'd ignored the steep scenery in favor of a sphere of pink lucite and the jittery dance of mercury at its core. The knob crowned the bent steel stem of the transmission lever, slightly larger than a baseball. It had been cast around a crouching spider, blown from clear glass, hollow, half-filled with quicksilver. Mercury jumped and slid when the driver slapped the bus through switchback curves, swayed and shivered in the straightaways. The knob was ridiculous, handmade, baleful. It was there to welcome him back to Mexico. Among the dozen-odd Microsofts the Dutchman had given him was one that would allow a limited fluency in Spanish. But in Vallarta, he'd fumbled behind his left ear and inserted a dust plug instead, hiding the socket and plug beneath a square of flesh-tone micropore. A passenger near the back of the bus had a radio. A voice had periodically interrupted the brassy pop to recite a kind of litany, strings of 10-digit figures, the day's winning numbers in the national lottery. The woman beside him stirred in her sleep. He raised himself on one elbow to look at her. A stranger's face, but not the one his life in hotels had taught him to expect. He would have expected a routine beauty, bred out of cheap elective surgery and the relentless Darwinism of fashion, an archetype cooked down from the major media faces of the previous 5 years. Something Midwestern in the bone of the jaw, archaic and American. The blue sheets were rucked across her hips, the sunlight angling in through hardwood louvers to stripe her long thighs with diagonals of gold. The faces he woke with in the world's hotels were like God's own hood ornaments. Women sleeping faces, identical and alone, naked, aimed straight out to the void. But this one was different. Already, somehow, there was meaning attached to it. Meaning and a name. He sat up, swinging his legs off the bed. His soles registered the grit of beach sand on cool tile. There was a faint, pervasive smell of insecticide. Naked, head throbbing, he stood. He made his legs move, walked, tried the first of two doors, finding white tile, more white plaster, a bulbous chrome shower head hung from rust-spotted iron pipe. The sink's taps offered identical trickles of blood-warm water. An antique wristwatch lay beside a plastic tumbler, a mechanical Rolex on a pale leather strap. The bathroom's shuttered windows were unglazed, strung with a fine green mesh of plastic. He peered out between hardwood slats, wincing at the hot, clean sun, and saw a dry fountain of flower-painted tiles and the rusted carcass of a VW rabbit. Allison. That was her name. She wore frayed khaki shorts and one of his white t-shirts. Her legs were very brown. The clockwork Rolex, with its dull stainless case, went around her left wrist on its pigskin strap. They went walking down the curve of beach, toward Barra de Navidad. They kept to the narrow strip of firm wet sand above the line of surf. Already they had a history together. He remembered her at a stall that morning in the little town's iron-roofed mercado, how she'd held the huge clay mug of boiled coffee in both hands. mopping eggs and salsa from the cracked white plate with a tortilla. He'd watched flies circling fingers of sunlight that found their way through a patchwork of palm frond and corrugated siding. Some talk about her job with some legal firm in L.A., how she lived alone in one of the ramshackle pontoon towns tethered off Redondo. He'd told her he was in personnel, or had been anyway. Maybe I'm looking for a new line of work. But talk seemed secondary to what there was between them. And now a frigate bird hung overhead, tacking against the breeze, slid sideways, wheeled, and was gone. They both shivered with the freedom of it, the mindless glide of the thing. She squeezed his hand. A blue figure came marching up the beach toward them. A military policeman headed for town. Spit-shined black boots unreal against the soft, bright beach. As the man passed, his face dark and immobile beneath mirrored glasses. Turner noted the carbine format Steiner optic laser with Fabrique Nationale sights. The blue fatigues were spotless, creased like knives. Turner had been a soldier in his own right for most of his adult life, although he'd never worn a uniform. A mercenary. His employers, vast corporations warring covertly for the control of entire economies. He was a specialist in the extraction of top executives and research people. The multinationals he worked for would never admit that men like Turner existed.
"You worked your way through most of a bottle of Herradura last night," she said.
He nodded. Her hand in his was warm and dry. He was watching the spread of her toes with each step, the nails painted with chipped pink gloss. The breakers rolled in, their edges transparent as green glass. The spray beaded on her tan. After their first day together, life fell into a simple pattern. They had breakfast in the Mercado, at a stall with a concrete counter worn smooth as polished marble. They spent the morning swimming, until the sun drove them back into the shuttered coolness of the hotel, where they made love under the slow wooden blades of the ceiling fan, then slept. In the afternoons, they explored the maze of narrow streets behind the Avenida, or went hiking in the hills. They dined in beachfront restaurants and drank on the patios of the white hotels. Moonlight curled in the edge of the surf. And, gradually, without words, she taught him a new style of passion. He was accustomed to being served, serviced anonymously by skilled professionals. Now, in the white cave, he knelt on tile. He lowered his head, licking her. Salt Pacific mixed with her own wet. Her inner thighs cool against his cheeks. Palms cradling her hips. He held her. Raised her like a chalice. Lips pressing tight. While his tongue sought the locus. The point. The frequency that would bring her home. Then, grinning, he'd mount, enter, and find his own way there. Sometimes then he'd talk. Long spirals of unfocused narrative that spun out to join the sound of the sea. She said very little. But he'd learned to value what little she did say. And always, she held him. And listened. A week passed, then another. He woke to their final day together in that same cool room, finding her beside him. Over breakfast, he imagined he felt a change in her. A tension. They sunbathed, swam, and in the familiar bed, he forgot the faint edge of anxiety. In the afternoon, she suggested they walk down the beach, toward Barre, the way they'd gone that first morning. Turner extracted the dust plug from the socket behind his ear and inserted a sliver of Microsoft.
The structure of Spanish settled through him like a tower of glass. Invisible gates hinged on present and future, conditional, preterite perfect. Leaving her in the room, he crossed the avenida and entered the market. He bought a straw basket, cans of cold beer, sandwiches and fruit. On his way back, he bought a new pair of sunglasses from the vendor in the avenida. His tan was dark and even. The angular patchwork left by the Dutchman's grafts was gone, and she had taught him the unity of his body. Mornings, when he met the green eyes in the bathroom mirror, they were his own, and the Dutchman no longer troubled his dreams with bad jokes and a dry cough. Sometimes, still, he dreamed fragments of India, a country he barely knew. Bright splinters. Chandni Chowk. The smell of dust and fried breads. The walls of the ruined hotel stood a quarter of the way down the bay's arc. The surf here was stronger, each wave a detonation. Now she tugged him toward it. Something new at the corners of her eyes. A tightness. Gulls scattered as they came hand in hand up the beach to gaze into shadow beyond empty doorways. The sand had subsided, allowing the structure's facade to cave in, walls gone, leaving the floors of the three levels hung like huge shingles from bent, rusted tendons of finger-thick steel, each one faced with a different color and pattern of tile. Hotel Playa del M was worked in childlike seashell capitals above one concrete arch. "Mar," he said, completing it, though he'd removed the Microsoft.
"It's over,"
she said, stepping beneath the arch into shadow. "What's over?" He followed, the straw basket rubbing against his hip. The sand here was cold, dry, loose between his toes.
"Over. Done with. This place. No time here. No future."
He stared at her, glanced past her to where rusted bedsprings were tangled at the junction of two crumbling walls. "It smells like piss," he said. "Let's swim." The sea took the chill away, but a distance hung between them now. They sat on a blanket from Turner's room and ate, silently. The shadow of the ruin lengthened. The wind moved her sun-streaked hair. "You make me think about horses," he said finally.
"Well,"
she said, as though she spoke from the depths of exhaustion.
"They've only been extinct for 30 years.
"No," he said. "Their hair. The hair on their necks when they ran."
"Manes,"
she said, and there were tears in her eyes.
"Fuck it."
Her shoulders began to heave. She took a deep breath. She tossed her empty Carta Blanca can down the beach.
"It, me. What's it matter?"
Her arms around him again.
"Oh, come on, Turner. Come on."
And as she lay back, pulling him with her, he noticed something. A boat, reduced by distance to a white hyphen, where the water met the sky. When he sat up, pulling on his cut-off jeans, he saw the yacht. It was much closer now. A graceful sweep of white riding low on the water. Deep water. The beach must fall away almost vertically here, judging by the strength of the surf. That would be why the line of hotels ended where it did, back along the beach, and why the ruin hadn't survived. The waves had licked away its foundation. "Give me the basket." She was buttoning her blouse. He'd bought it for her in one of the tired little shops along the avenida. Electric blue Mexican cotton,
badly made. The clothing they bought in the shop seldom lasted more than a day or two. I said, "Give me the basket." She did. He dug through the remains of their afternoon, finding his binoculars beneath a plastic bag of pineapple slices drenched in lime and dusted with cayenne. He pulled them out, a compact pair of 6x30 combat glasses. He snapped the integral covers from the objectives and the padded eyepieces, and studied the streamlined ideograms of the Hosaka logo. A yellow inflatable rounded the stern and swung toward the beach.
"Turner, I..."
"Get up." Bundling the blanket and her towel into the basket, he took a last warm can of Carta Blanca from the basket and put it beside the binoculars. He stood, pulling her quickly to her feet, and forced the basket into her hands. "Maybe I'm wrong," he said. "If I am, get out of here. Cut for that second stand of palms." He pointed. "Don't go back to the hotel. Get on a bus, Manzanillo or Vallarta. Go home." He could hear the purr of the outboard now. He saw the tears start, but she made no sound at all as she turned and ran, up past the ruin, clutching the basket, stumbling in a drift of sand. She didn't look back. He turned then and looked toward the yacht. The inflatable was bouncing through the surf. The yacht was named Tsushima, and he'd last seen her in Hiroshima Bay. He'd seen the red Shinto gate at Itsukushima from her deck. He didn't need the glasses to know that the inflatable's passenger would be Conroy, the pilot, one of Hosaka's ninjas. He sat down cross-legged in the cooling sand and opened his last can of Mexican beer. He looked back at the line of white hotels, his hands inert on one of Tsushima's teak railings. Behind the hotels, the little town's three holograms glowed. Banamex, Aeronaves, and the cathedral's 6-meter virgin. Conroy stood beside him.
"Crash job," Conroy said. "You know how it is."
Conroy's voice was flat and uninflected, as though he'd modeled it after a cheap voice chip. His face was broad and white, dead white. His eyes were dark-ringed and hooded, beneath the peroxide thatch combed back from a wide forehead. He wore a black polo shirt and black slacks.
"Inside," he said, turning.
Turner followed, ducking to enter the cabin door. White screens, pale, flawless pine. Tokyo's austere corporate chic. Conroy settled himself on a low rectangular cushion of slate-gray ultra-suede. Turner stood, his hands slack at his sides. Conroy took a knurled silver inhaler from the low enamel table between them.
"Choline enhancer?"
"No." Conroy jammed the inhaler into one nostril and snorted.
"You want some sushi?"
He put the inhaler back on the table.
"We caught a couple of red snapper about an hour ago."
Turner stood where he was, staring at Conroy.
"Christopher Mitchell," Conroy said. "Moss Biolabs. Their head hybridoma man. He's coming over to Hosaka."
"Never heard of him."
"Bullshit. How about a drink?"
Turner shook his head.
"Silicon's on the way out, Turner. Mitchell's the man who made biochips work, and Moss is sitting on the major patents. You know that. He's the man for monoclonals. He wants out. You and me, Turner, we're going to shift him."
"I think I'm retired, Conroy. I was having a good time back there."
That's what the psych team in Tokyo say. I mean, it's not exactly your first time out of the box, is it? She's a field psychologist on retainer to Hosaka.
A muscle in Turner's thigh began to jump.
They say you're ready, Turner. They were a little worried after New Delhi, so they wanted to check it out. Little therapy on the side. Never hurts, does it?
Chapter 2 Marley. She'd worn her best for the interview, but it was raining in Brussels and she had no money for a cab. She walked from the Eurotram station, her hand in the pocket of her good jacket. A Sally Stanley, but almost a year old, was a white knot around the crumpled telefax. She no longer needed it, having memorized the address. But it seemed she could no more release it than break the trance that held her here now, staring into the window of an expensive shop that sold menswear, her focus phasing between sedate flannel dress shirts and the reflection of her own dark eyes. Surely the eyes alone would be enough to cost her the job. No need for the wet hair she now wished she'd let Andrea cut. The eyes displayed a pain and an inertia that anyone could read. And most certainly these things would soon be revealed to Herr Josef Virek, least likely of potential employers. When the telefax had been delivered, she'd insisted on regarding it as some cruel prank, another nuisance call. She'd had enough of those, thanks to the media. So many that Andrea had ordered a special program for the apartment's phone. One that filtered out incoming calls from any number that wasn't listed in her permanent directory. But that, Andrea had insisted, must have been the reason for the telefax. How else could anyone reach her? But Marley had shaken her head and huddled deeper into Andrea's old terry robe. Why would Virek, enormously wealthy collector and patron, wish to hire the disgraced former operator of a tiny Paris gallery? Then it had been Andrea's time for headshaking, in her impatience with the new, the disgraced Marley Krushkova, who spent entire days in the apartment now, who sometimes didn't bother to dress. The attempted sale in Paris of a single forgery was hardly the novelty Marley imagined it to have been, she said. If the press hadn't been quite so anxious to show up the disgusting Nas for the fool he most assuredly was, she continued, the business would hardly have been news. Nas was wealthy enough, gross enough to make for a weekend scandal. Andrea smiled. If you had been less attractive, you would have gotten far less attention. Marley shook her head. And the forgery was Alain's. You were innocent. Have you forgotten that? Marley went into the bathroom, still huddled in the threadbare robe, without answering. Beneath her friend's wish to comfort, to help, Marley could already sense the impatience of someone forced to share a very small space with an unhappy, non-paying guest. And Andrea had had to loan her the fare for the Eurotrans. With a conscious, painful effort of will, she broke from the circle of her thoughts and merged with the dense but sedate flow of serious Belgian shoppers. A girl in bright tights and a boyfriend's oversized Loden jacket brushed past, scrubbed and smiling. At the next intersection, Marley noticed an outlet for a fashion line she'd favored in her own student days. The clothes looked impossibly young. In her white and secret fist, the telefax.
Galerie du Puré, 14 Rue Aubert, Bruxelles. Josef Virek.
The receptionist in the cool gray anteroom of the Galerie du Puré might well have grown there. a lovely and likely poisonous plant, rooted behind a slab of polished marble, inlaid with an enameled keyboard. She raised lustrous eyes as Marley approached. Marley imagined the click and whir of shutters, her bedraggled image whisked away to some far corner of Yosef Virek's empire.
Marley Khrushchova, she said,
fighting the urge to produce the compacted wad of telefax, smooth it pathetically on the cool and flawless marble.
For Herr Virek, Fraulein Khrushchova.
The receptionist said,
Herr Virek is unable to be in Brussels today.
Marley stared at the perfect lips, simultaneously aware of the pain the words caused her and the sharp pleasure she was learning to take in disappointment.
I see. However, he has chosen to conduct the interview via a sensory link. If you will please enter the third door on your left.
The room was bare and white. On two walls hung unframed sheets of what looked like rain-stained cardboard, stabbed through repeatedly with a variety of instruments.
Katatonenkunst.
Conservative. The sort of work once sold to committees sent round by the boards of Dutch commercial banks. She sat down on a low bench covered in leather and finally allowed herself to release the telefax. She was alone, but assumed that she was being observed somehow.
Fraulein Khrushchova.
A young man in a technician's dark green smock stood in the doorway opposite the one through which she'd entered.
In a moment, please, you will cross the room and step through this door. Please grasp the knob slowly, firmly, and in a manner that affords maximum contact with the flesh of your palm. Step through carefully. There should be a minimum of spatial disorientation.
She blinked at him.
I beg the sensory link, he said,
and withdrew, the door closing behind him. She rose, tried to tug some shape into the damp lapels of her jacket, touched her hair, thought better of it, took a deep breath, and crossed to the door. The receptionist's phrase had prepared her for the only kind of link she knew, a SimStim signal routed via Bell Europa. She'd assumed she'd wear a helmet studded with dermatrodes, that Virek would use a passive viewer as a human camera. But Virek's wealth was on another scale of magnitude entirely. As her fingers closed around the cool brass knob, it seemed to squirm, sliding along a touch spectrum of texture and temperature in the first second of contact. Then it became metal again. Green-painted iron, sweeping out and down along a line of perspective. An old railing she grasped now in wonder. A few drops of rain blew into her face. Smell of rain and wet earth. A confusion of small details. Her own memory of a drunken art school picnic warring with the perfection of Virek's illusion. Below her lay the unmistakable panorama of Barcelona, smoke hazing the strange spires of the Church of the Sagrada Familia. She caught the railing with her other hand as well, fighting vertigo. She knew this place. She was in the Güell Park, Antonio Gaudí's tatty fairyland on its barren rise behind the center of the city. To her left, a giant lizard of crazy quilt ceramic was frozen in mid-slide down a ramp of rough stone. Its fountain grin watered a bed of tired flowers.
You are disoriented. Please forgive me.
Josef Virek was perched below her on one of the park's serpentine benches, his wide shoulders hunched in a soft topcoat. His features had been vaguely familiar to her all her life. Now she remembered for some reason a photograph of Virek and the King of England. He smiled at her. His head was large and beautifully shaped beneath a brush of stiff dark gray hair. His nostrils were permanently flared, as though he sniffed invisible winds of art and commerce. His eyes, very large behind the round, rimless glasses that were a trademark, were pale blue and strangely soft.
"Please."
He patted the bench's random mosaic of shattered pottery with a narrow hand.
"You must forgive my reliance on technology. I have been confined for over a decade to a vat in some hideous industrial suburb of Stockholm, or perhaps of hell. I am not a well man, Marley. Sit beside me."
Taking a deep breath, she descended the stone steps and crossed the cobbles.
"Herr Virek," she said, "I saw you lecture in Munich 2 years ago, a critique of Fessler and his Autistisches Theater. You seemed well then."
"Fessler?"
Virek's tanned forehead wrinkled.
"You saw a double. A hologram, perhaps. Many things, Marley, are perpetrated in my name. Aspects of my wealth have become autonomous by degrees. At times they even war with one another. Rebellion in the fiscal extremities. However, for reasons so complex as to be entirely occult, the fact of my illness has never been made public."
She took her place beside him and peered down at the dirty pavement between the scuffed toes of her black Paris boots. She saw a chip of pale gravel, a rusted paperclip, the small dusty corpse of a bee or hornet.
"It's amazingly detailed." "Yes," he said. "The new mass biochips. You should know," he continued, "that what I know of your private life is very nearly as detailed. More than you yourself do in some instances."
"You do?"
It was easiest, she found, to focus on the city. Picking out landmarks remembered from a half dozen student holidays. There, just there, would be the Ramblas, parrots and flowers, the tavern serving dark beer and squid.
"Yes, I know that it was your lover who convinced you that you had found a lost Cornell original."
Marley shut her eyes.
"He commissioned the forgery, hiring two talented student artisans and an established historian who found himself in certain personal difficulties. He paid them with money he'd already extracted from your gallery, as you have no doubt guessed."
"You are crying."
Marley nodded. A cool forefinger tapped her wrist.
"I bought Nass. I bought the police off the case. The press weren't worth buying. They rarely are. And now perhaps your slight notoriety may work to your advantage."
"Herr Virek, I..."
"A moment, please. Paco! Come here, child."
Marley opened her eyes and saw a child of perhaps 6 years, tightly gotten up in dark suit coat and knickers, pale stockings, high-buttoned, black-patterned boots. Brown hair fell across his forehead in a smooth wing. He held something in his hands. A box of some kind.
"Gaudí began the park in 1900.
Virek said,
"Paco wears the period costume. Come here, child. Show us your marvel."
"Señor."
Paco lisped, bowing and stepped forward to exhibit the thing he held. Marley stared. Box of plain wood, glass-fronted. Objects.
Cornell,
she said, her tears forgotten.
Cornell?
She turned to Virik.
Of course not. The object set into that length of bone is a brown biomonitor. This is the work of a living artist.
There are more? More boxes?
I have found 7. Over a period of 3 years. The Virik collection, you see, is a sort of black hole. The unnatural density of my wealth drags irresistibly at the rarest works of the human spirit. An autonomous process, and one I ordinarily take little interest in.
But Marley was lost in the box, in its evocation of impossible distances, of loss and yearning. It was somber, gentle, and somehow childlike. It contained 7 objects. The slender, fluted bone, surely formed for flight, surely from the wing of some large bird. 3 archaic circuit boards, faced with mazes of gold. A smooth white sphere of baked clay. An age-blackened fragment of lace. A finger-length segment of what she assumed was bone from a human wrist. Grayish-white, inset smoothly with the silicon shaft of a small instrument that must once have ridden flush with the surface of the skin. But the thing's face was seared and blackened. The box was a universe, a poem frozen on the boundaries of human experience.
Gracias, Paco.
Box and boy were gone. She gaped.
Ah, forgive me. I have forgotten that these transitions are too abrupt for you. Now, however, we must discuss your assignment.
Herr Virik, she said. What is Paco?
A sub-program.
I see.
I have hired you to find the maker of the box.
But, Herr Virik, with your resources,
of which you are now one child,
do you not wish to be employed?
When the business of Nas, having been stung with a forged Cornell, came to my attention, I saw that you might be of use in this matter.
He shrugged.
Credit me with a certain talent for obtaining desired results.
Certainly, Herr Virik. And yes, I do wish to work.
Very well. You will be paid a salary. You will be given access to certain lines of credit. Although, should you need to purchase, let us say, substantial amounts of real estate.
Real estate?
Or a corporation or spacecraft. In that event, you will require my indirect authorization, which you will almost certainly be given. Otherwise, you will have a free hand. I suggest, however, that you work on a scale with which you yourself are comfortable. Otherwise, you run the risk of losing touch with your intuition. And intuition, in a case such as this, is of crucial importance.
The famous smile glittered for her once more. She took a deep breath.
Herr Virik, what if I fail? How long do I have to locate this artist?
The rest of your life,
he said.
Forgive me,
she found herself saying to her horror.
But I understood you to say that you live in a vat?
Yes, Marley. And from that rather terminal perspective, I should advise you to strive to live hourly in your own flesh. Not in the past, if you understand me. I speak as one who can no longer tolerate that simple state. The cells of my body having opted for the quixotic pursuit of individual careers. I imagine that a more fortunate man, or a poorer one, would have been allowed to die at last, or be coded at the core of some bit of hardware. But I seem constrained by a Byzantine net of circumstance that requires, I understand, something like a tenth of my annual income, making me, I suppose, the world's most expensive invalid. I was touched, Marley, at your affairs of the heart. I envy you the ordered flesh from which they unfold.
And for an instant she stared directly into those soft blue eyes and knew, with an instinctive mammalian certainty, that the exceedingly rich were no longer even remotely human. A wing of night swept Barcelona's sky like the twitch of a vast slow shutter, and Virik and Gwell were gone, and she found herself seated again on the low leather bench, staring at torn sheets of stained cardboard. Chapter 3. Bobby pulls a Wilson.
It was such an easy thing, death. He saw that now. It just happened. You screwed up by a fraction, and there it was. Something chill and odorless, ballooning out from the four stupid corners of the room. Your mother's Barrytown living room. Shit, he thought. Two a day I'll laugh his ass off. First time out and I pull a Wilson. The only sound in the room was the faint steady burr of his teeth vibrating. Supersonic palsy as the feedback ate into his nervous system. He watched his frozen hand as it trembled delicately, centimeters from the red plastic stud that could break the connection that was killing him. Shit. He'd come home and gotten right down to it. Slotted the icebreaker he'd rented from Two a Day and jacked in, punching for the base he'd chosen as his first live target. Figured that was the way to do it. You want to do it, then do it. He'd only had the little Ono Sendai deck for a month, but he already knew he wanted to be more than just some Barrytown hot dogger. Bobby Newmark, a.k.a. Count Zero. But it was already over. Shows never ended this way. Not right at the beginning. In a show, the cowboy hero's girl, or maybe his partner, would run in, slap the trodes off, hit that little red off stud. So you'd make it through. But Bobby was alone now, his autonomic nervous system overridden by the defenses of a database 3,000 kilometers from Barrytown, and he knew it. There was some magic chemistry in that impending darkness, something that let him glimpse the infinite desirability of that room with its carpet-colored carpet and curtain-colored curtains, its dingy foam sofa suite, the angular chrome frame supporting the components of a 6-year-old Hitachi entertainment module. He'd carefully closed those curtains in preparation for his run. But now, somehow, he seemed to see out anyway. With the condos of Barrytown crested back in their concrete wave to break against the darker towers of the projects. That condo wave bristled with the fine insect fur of antennas and chicken-wired dishes strung with lines of drying clothes. His mother liked to bitch about that. She had a dryer. He remembered her knuckles white on the imitation bronze of the balcony railing, dry wrinkles where her wrist was bent. He remembered a dead boy, carried out a big playground on an alloy stretcher, bundled in plastic, the same color as a cop car. Fell and hit his head. Fell. Head. Wilson.
His heart stopped. It seemed to him that it fell sideways, kicked like an animal in a cartoon. 16th second of Bobby Newmark's death. His hot dogger's death. And something leaned in. Vastness unutterable from beyond the most distant edge of anything he'd ever known or imagined, and touched him.
What are you doing? Why are they doing that to you?
Girl voice, brown hair, dark eyes.
Killing me, get it off, get it off!
Dark eyes, desert star, tan shirt, girl hair.
But it's a trick, see? You only think it's got you. Look, now I fit here, and you aren't carrying the loop.
And his heart rolled right over on its back and kicked his lunch up with its red cartoon legs, galvanic frog leg spasm hurling him from the chair and tearing the trodes from his forehead. His bladder let go when his head clipped the corner of the Hitachi, and someone was saying fuck, fuck, fuck into the dust smell of carpet. Girl voice gone. No desert star. Flash impression of cool wind and water-worn stone. Then his head exploded. He saw it very clearly from somewhere far away. Like a phosphorus grenade. White. Light.
Chapter 4. Clocking in.
The black Honda hovered 20 meters above the octagonal deck of the derelict oil rig. It was nearing dawn, and Turner could make out the faded outline of a biohazard trefoil marking the helicopter pad.
You got a biohazard down there, Conroy?
None you aren't used to, Conroy said. A figure in a red jumpsuit made brisk arm signals to the Honda's pilot. Propwash flung scraps of packing waste into the sea as they landed. Conroy slapped the release plate on his harness and leaned across Turner to unseal the hatch. The roar of the engines battered them as the hatch slid open. Conroy was jabbing him in the shoulder, making urgent lifting motions with an upturned palm. He pointed to the pilot. Turner scrambled out and dropped, the prop a blur of thunder. Then Conroy was crouching beside him. They cleared the faded trefoil with the bent-legged crab scuttle common to helicopter pads, the Honda's wind snapping their pants legs around their ankles. Turner carried a plain gray suitcase, molded from ballistic ABS, his only piece of luggage. Someone had packed it for him at the hotel, and it had been waiting on Tsushima. A sudden change in pitch told him the Honda was rising. It went whining away toward the coast, showing no lights. As the sound faded, Turner heard the cries of gulls and the slap and slide of the Pacific.
Someone tried to set up a data haven here once, Conroy said. International waters. Back then nobody lived in orbit, so it made sense for a few years.
He started for a rusted forest of beam supporting the rig's superstructure.
One scenario Hosaka showed me. We'd get Mitchell out here, clean him up, stick him on Tsushima, and full steam for old Japan. I told him forget that shit. Moss gets onto it and they can come down on this thing with anything they want. I told him that compound they got down on the DF, that's the ticket, right?
Plenty of shit Moss wouldn't pull there. Not in the fucking middle of Mexico City. A figure stepped from the shadows, head distorted by the bulbous goggles of an image amplification rig. It waved them on with the blunt clustered muzzles of a Lansing flechette gun.
Biohazard, Conroy said as they edged past.
Duck your head here and watch it. The stairs get slippery. The rig smelled of rust and disuse and brine. There were no windows. The discolored cream walls were blotched with spreading scabs of rust. Battery-powered fluorescent lanterns were slung every few meters from beams overhead, casting a hideous green-tinged light, at once intense and naggingly uneven. At least a dozen figures were at work in this central room. They moved with the relaxed precision of good technicians. Professionals, Turner thought. Their eyes seldom met, and there was little talking. It was cold, very cold, and Conroy had given him a huge parka covered with tabs and zippers. A bearded man in a sheepskin bomber jacket was securing bundled lengths of fiber optic line to a dented bulkhead with silver tape. Conroy was locked in a whispered argument with a black woman who wore a parka like Turner's. The bearded tech looked up from his work and saw Turner.
"Shit,"
he said, still on his knees.
"I figured it was a big one, but I guess it's gonna be a rough one, too."
He stood wiping his palms automatically on his jeans. Like the rest of the techs, he wore micropore surgical gloves.
"You're Turner."
He grinned, glanced quickly in Conroy's direction, and pulled a black plastic flask from a jacket pocket.
"Take some chill off. You remember me. Worked on that job in Marrakesh. IBM boy went over to Mitsuji, wired the charges on that bus you and the Frenchman drove into that hotel lobby."
Turner took the flask, snapped its lid, and tipped it. Bourbon. It stung deep and sour, warmth spreading from the region of his sternum.
"Thanks."
He returned the flask and the man pocketed it.
"Oki," the man said. "Name's Oki. You remember?"
"Sure," Turner lied. "Marrakesh."
"Wild turkey," Oki said.
"Flew in through ski pole. I hit the duty free. Your partner there?"
Another glance at Conroy.
"He's none too relaxed, is he? I mean, not like Marrakesh, right?"
Turner nodded.
"You need anything?" Oki said. "Let me know."
"Like what?"
"Another drink? Or I got some Peruvian flake, the kind that's real yellow."
Oki grinned again.
"Thanks,"
Turner said, seeing Conroy turn from the black woman. Oki saw two, kneeling quickly and tearing off a fresh length of silver tape.
"Who is that?"
Conroy asked, after leading Turner through a narrow door with decayed black gasket seals at its edges. Conroy spun the wheel that dogged the door shut. Someone had oiled it recently.
"Name's Oki,"
Turner said, taking in the new room. Smaller. Two of the lanterns, folding tables, chairs, all new. On the tables, instrumentation of some kind under black plastic dust covers. "Friend of yours?"
"No," Turner said. "He worked for me once."
He went to the nearest table and flipped back a dust cover.
"What's this?"
The console had the blank, half-finished look of a factory prototype.
"Moss Neotech cyberspace deck."
Turner raised his eyebrows.
"Yours?"
"We got two. One's on site. From Osaka. Fastest thing in the Matrix, evidently. And Osaka can't even de-engineer the chips to copy them. Whole other technology."
"They got them from Mitchell?"
"They aren't saying. The fact they'd let go of them, just to give our jockeys an edge, is some indication of how badly they want the man."
"Who's on console, Conroy?"
"Jaylene Slide. I was talking to her just now." He jerked his head in the direction of the door. "The site man's out of L.A., kid called Ramirez."
"They any good?"
Turner replaced the dust cover.
"Better be, for what they'll cost.
Jaylene's gotten herself a hot rep the past 2 years, and Ramirez is her understudy."
"Shit."
Conroy shrugged. "You know these cowboys.
fucking crazy. Where'd you get them? Where'd you get Oki, for that matter?
Conroy smiled.
From your agent, Turner.